Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. We begin with two stories from the WFPL newsroom on the popularity of amusement parks and the patchwork of regulations aimed at keeping them safe. First, it's not unusual to hear someone compare a rough economy to a roller coaster ride. But how is the country's fiscal downturn affecting America's real roller coaster owners? WFPL's Gabe Bullard reports.
As Six Flags Kentucky Kingdom spokesperson Carolyn McLean walks through the park, she points out how the crowds have changed.
We've seen an increase in folks that are coming from outside of our core market. Often we talk to a lot of people that are walking the park and they're coming from Nashville, Bowling Green, West Virginia, Lexington, and they're doing sort of what we call a staycation.
At the beginning of the summer, travel experts predicted the staycation trend. They said Americans would be more likely to save money this season by foregoing long-distance family vacations and staying closer to home. That's what Robin Burris of Cecilia, Kentucky decided to do. Her family used to take vacations to places like
Hilton Head, Florida, California.
But not anymore.
Prices were too high, yeah. Checked around on different prices at different resorts and things, and we just decided to stay close to home.
And all those so-called staycationers are a boon for an urban theme park like Kentucky Kingdom. Again, Carolyn McLean.
We feel very fortunate. You know, the economy is definitely tight, but our business has remained up and good.
But for a park that's farther away from an urban area, the story is a little different.
The economy probably affects us two different ways, and they tend to go different directions.
Will Cook is the president of the Holiday World Amusement Park in Santa Claus, Indiana, about 70 miles west of Louisville.
A lot of people have had some extra costs added into their monthly budgets that they hadn't been prepared to spend, and so there are some folks out there who are just have to find ways to fit the budget on a month-to-month basis.
Like Kentucky Kingdom, Holiday World is getting more visitors who can't afford a trip to places like Florida. But it's also lost customers whose annual vacation was a day or two at the amusement park.
Those folks may choose to delay a trip to a park like ours and maybe say, well, we'll go next year or that kind of thing.
Both Holiday World and Six Flags haven't released their summer numbers. But the Cedar Fair Company, which runs the Kings Island and Cedar Point amusement parks in Ohio, just announced an increase of about 1 million visitors across its 11 amusement parks. Back at Kentucky Kingdom, staycationer Robin Burris says if the financial roller coaster continues on its current course, she'll be riding a real one again next summer.
Do you think this will be a continuing trend, like next year, same thing?
If things don't change in the economy, oh yeah.
For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
More than 250 million people will visit regional amusement parks across the nation this year, but as WFPL's Kristen Espeland reports, park safety standards are all over the map.
In Kentucky, the State Department of Agriculture is responsible for inspecting rides. In Indiana, it's the Division of Elevator Safety. In Florida, there are no state regulations. While the number of injuries on all kinds of rides has climbed steadily over the past decade nationwide, deaths and serious injuries are relatively rare. But it only takes one catastrophic accident to change a life. Kathy Fackler's son lost part of his foot on a roller coaster in California. 2 years later, she founded the advocacy organization Safer Parks.
And in the aftermath of the accident, I learned how little government oversight there was of serious accidents in major theme parks.
The Federal Consumer Product Safety Commission used to regulate all amusement parks, from Disneyland to traveling fairs. But in 1981, the amusement park industry lobbied Congress to change that. The change removed so-called fixed-site parks from the CPSC's jurisdiction and left it to regulate only traveling parks. Again, Kathy Fackler.
So it was a couple lines in a, you know, 1,000-page bill that nobody really saw before they voted on it, and it deregulated an entire industry in one fell swoop.
Since then, most, but not all, states have established their own programs to regulate and inspect rides. And Fackler says state inspectors, as well as the industry, work hard to keep rides safe. But she says reinstating federal oversight would allow states to tap federal resources like engineers and scientists for major accident investigations. Kentucky Department of Agriculture spokesman Bill Clary says federal oversight could potentially improve safety.
We would be in favor of federal jurisdiction if the federal government's rules were at least as strict as ours or stricter.
The department's investigation of last year's accident at Six Flags Kentucky Kingdom, when a worn-out cable on the Tower of Power ride snapped and severed off a teenager's feet, found that park operators were using an outdated maintenance manual for the ride. Inspectors fined the park $1,000 for failing to maintain the ride. Clary says those fines will now be higher, and the state legislature has since passed new park safety laws.
The amusement ride operators themselves have to conduct a daily inspection of every ride, and they have to maintain the records of those inspections for us. Under the law that existed before this year, that wasn't necessarily the case.
Clary says legislators also gave the department about $200,000 to hire more inspectors, but it also cut their operating budget by $3 million. Clary says 20 years ago, two dozen inspectors looked over a few hundred rides. Today, there are 8 full-time inspectors performing thousands of checks. He says they do manage to inspect every ride once a year, but they'd like to do more.
What we would like to be able to do is do more re-inspections because things change over time.
The amusement park industry, from park operators to ride manufacturers, follows many safety guidelines of its own. Many members have adopted the International Safety and Design Standards, known as F24, and many ride inspectors, from state employees to insurance company consultants, voluntarily seek certification and ongoing training. And some industry members say that's plenty. The president of the International Association of Amusement Parks and Attractions insists this $25 billion industry can keep patrons safe without federal intervention. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
More information about amusement parks and amusement park safety is available at our website, WFPL.org. Kristen Espeland will rejoin us later in the program for a report on the effectiveness of air quality alerts. August 26th is Women's Equality Day. It commemorates the 1920 passage of the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote. But not all women thought getting the vote was such a good idea. WFPL's Robin Fisher talks with actress Michelle LaRue about her one-woman show, Someone Must Wash the Dishes, which looks at the arguments of the anti-suffragists.
Michelle, welcome to Studio 619.
Thank you.
Tell us about how you got started with the one-woman play and in the history plays in particular.
Well, my late husband founded a theater company called the East Lynn Company, which is still running in southern New Jersey and tours. And the purpose of that was to do the old plays that nobody, even in the theater, knows about anymore. And as an offshoot of that, there were some one-person performances involved. And we stumbled on a short story that he remembered from his youth called The Yellow Wallpaper. And that was my first one-woman show. I still perform that. It's a wonderful Edgar Allan Poe's car story based on the writer's own nervous breakdown.
And that's Charlotte Perkins Gilman?
Yes, it is. It's the Gilman.
Now, most of the plays that you do actually do deal with women's issues, and you'll be in town to perform the one called Someone Has to Wash the Dishes.
It's Someone Must Wash the Dishes.
Someone Must Wash the Dishes. Tell us about that play.
It was written by Marie Jenny Howe, who was a reformer, first a Unitarian minister in the Midwest, and then she and her husband moved to New York City, and she continued being a reformer and was a prominent suffragist, but nobody knows her because she was more catalytic than anything, and the correspondence between her and her husband didn't survive by their own wishes. And she was very important in spurring other women to do things like pro-suffrage. So the anti-suffrage monologue, which is what she called this piece, Someone Must Wash the Dishes, was written for people who believed we should have suffrage, but it was a much more entertaining way of doing it than to continue pounding at the anti-suffragists, telling them how silly their arguments were. This way we do it with laughter.
Now, was she poking fun at them, do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No question. It's a flat-out satire, and the genius of it is she knows all of the anti's arguments. She states them very clearly and in many cases juxtaposes them in such a way that they're clearly contradictory. And the character who's delivering this monologue has no idea that she's contradicting herself. She's a very helpful sort of woman, the kind of woman who we hope we don't have anymore, for whom whatever her husband says goes in one ear and out her mouth without stopping at the gray matter. So she's very helpful. The speaker assumes that everybody in the audience wants to be with her in helping find good arguments against women getting the vote.
Now, I've not seen your performance, but I have read the piece.
Oh, you have? Good.
And it is very funny, and at the same time, it's a little, it took me a little aback because, you know, I can hear some of those arguments. I can mm-hmm. hear some of those arguments coming out at that time, and even not necessarily at that time. And then the whole, you know, she follows right behind herself, you know, to contradict herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can, you know, it, the women will vote the way that their husbands vote, and therefore it's a voting block. Or the women will vote against their husbands, and then, you know, it will divide the families.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And I think it says a lot about every sort of movement in that vein where people just grasp at ways, they just use the same argument to argue both points.
Oh, sure. And there were apparently viable reasons at the time for each of these arguments. And I give a lecture after the performance that explains the context and tells who the antis were and takes some of the arguments in the performance and explains where they came from. And the most ludicrous-sounding things to us now were based in a perceived reality of the time. And whenever I do the one-person performances, I'm always putting them in the context of the time. And that's really how I started getting so interested in history, was doing the research for the Yellow Wallpaper and then subsequently this and my other performances.
Does your audience often feel that the character herself is someone real from history, or do they come away with an understanding that she wasn't real, but the woman who wrote the piece was actually a suffragist?
Once in a great while, I get somebody who comes up and has thought that this was a serious argument, but I do hand out programs with biographies and background notes, and as I said, there's the lecture afterwards.
You know, the play is based on a fictional work that was based on events that were happening at the time. Do you find that people don't give much credence to what was a very real anti-suffrage stance?
What I find, and it always astonishes me because I said I always come at these from an historical perspective, what always surprises me is how many women, particularly after a performance during the Q&A, say, "This hasn't changed," and give me specific examples. And one woman several years ago actually gave me a clipping from a newspaper about, at that time, a current Kansas legislatress, a woman in the Kansas legislature who was arguing that women should not have the vote because getting the vote led us to separate incomes, double incomes, which increased our expectations of what we should be earning and how we should be living, and therefore suffrage actually did break up the family. And this was, albeit Kansas, but I went to college in Kansas, and I know there are rational people there, this was a current argument.
Reading through the piece, I can see portions of it that were pulled from the real argument, because I feel like it's the argument that's been made about so many different things. You know, it's the reason that blacks shouldn't have been allowed to vote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we hear some of the same arguments now with the immigration debate.
Oh, sure. And there was some embarrassment involved within the suffrage movement, too. Predominantly, and I am generalizing to an extent, and I am not an historian, I'm an actress, but predominantly the movers and shakers behind the movement were upper-middle-class WASP women, and they carried all the prejudices that you would expect at that time. Even somebody like Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who wrote The Yellow Wallpaper, showed terrific prejudice. And there was a time in the move toward the franchise when things got ugly and, again, the movement split, when the Southern women, the Southerners particularly, were against the vote because if black women were enfranchised, then the number of blacks versus the number of whites who were eligible to vote in the South would just completely throw it in the other direction, and they were afraid. And in the urban areas, particularly in the North, you get a similar fear of all these foreigners who are coming in who, unlike 100 years before, no longer speak English or look like us. And we don't want these uneducated, unwashed foreigners coming in and taking our vote.
And Sojourner Truth kind of called him on the carpet on that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She sure did.
And
Frederick Douglass. And you don't have to look too far, but again, give them the education and anybody can vote.
I know that you are not an historian,
mm-hmm.
but what is it your understanding of the number of women who were anti-suffragists?
How do you mean that? What sort of women were they?
Or the number of women more. Would you say that half the women in the country were against it? Or do you have any sense of that?
I would, with a vague guess, say you'd probably have to divide that into three kinds of people because a lot of women weren't following it. A lot of women couldn't follow it. They either for language or social class or too busy scraping by. So the more common feeling would be against the vote. The popular press, like, I forget the titles of the magazines, but something like Ladies' Home Journal, were against it because this was not a womanly thing. Women certainly don't go out in public to talk about anything in mixed company, and they certainly don't vote. And to these upper middle class, WASP, enfranchised women, who for the most part are protected by their husbands, they don't understand why anybody would need the vote because they're taken care of.
Do you ever think about the women in your family and where they fell or would fall today in the argument?
Well, it was disappointing. I asked my grandmother, my mom's mother, with whom I was very close and who grew up in Iowa, and when I knew her, she was living in a town of 2,000 and had pretty much all her life, and she didn't do anything. And my father's mother, I don't know, but it's a good question. I imagine she was very ladylike and of German descent and sort of upper class. So I don't know if she would have thought it too unladylike to do it, but she was a working woman. She was a secretary.
And Michelle, tell us again the title of your piece.
It's called Someone Must Wash the Dishes, and the subtitle, which was the original title, is An Anti-Suffrage Monologue.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with actress Michelle LaRue about the anti-suffragist movement and her one-woman play, Someone Must Wash the Dishes. LaRue will perform the piece at 7 p.m. Saturday, August 23rd at the Fraser International History Museum. For more details, visit our website, WFPL.org. Still to come on Studio 619, higher natural gas prices will mean higher heating bills this winter. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. The Louisville Metro Air Pollution Control District has issued several air quality alerts so far this summer, but are people getting the message and doing anything different on those days? WFPL's Kristen Espeland reports.
When the air hangs windless in this Ohio River Valley, heat can spell trouble. That's when the city issues air quality alerts. Louisville's Air Pollution Control District spokesman Matt Stahl says they're meant to serve two purposes. One is to warn people who might be more susceptible to lung trouble.
In and of itself, the pollution is a concern, but then when you add that with the heat of the day, then people with lung issues, heart issues, the very young, the very old, they're going to really have a hard time. Number two, though, is to get people to do some things that would lessen the amount of pollution on that day.
Things like taking the bus, carpooling, combining errands. The air quality alerts mean there'll be a greater concentration of pollutants like soot and smog. Stahl says forecasters use everything from transportation data to weather models to determine whether to issue an alert.
There are meteorologists that we work with. They have a computer model that they use, and then our monitoring people here participate in a daily call with them, and they come up with, based on what that model tells them, and then based on their own knowledge, you know, what we're looking at for the next day.
And every fall, Stull says they conduct a survey of residents to find out if they're paying attention to the alerts and whether or not they'd be likely to do something about them.
What we've seen really over the last 7 years is a gradual increase in, you know, the knowledge base of people. And more importantly, we've also seen that more and more people are willing not just to learn about it, but to do something about it.
The survey results show that in the fall of 2005, about 86% of respondents said they'd heard of an air quality alert day. By November 2007, the number was 97%. Most respondents understood that air quality alerts meant that people with lung problems might have more trouble on those days. As for whether they said they were more likely to do things to help with the air, the results are mixed. In 2006, just 5% said they'd ride the bus. Last year, only 4%. Barry Barker heads Louisville's transit system, TARC. He says Louisvillians may not be hearing about air quality alerts with enough time to react.
Our sense is that the levels of ridership don't change very much because people have pretty much already made their plans of how they're going to get around on that given day.
It's one thing to make plans for the day when you don't have asthma or another kind of lung condition, but if you do, an air quality alert can send an entirely different message. The afternoon shift is just beginning for emergency doctor Brendan Weatherton at Jewish Hospital Medical Center East. This emergency department will probably see between 60 and 65 patients today. Normally, about three of those would complain of trouble breathing, wheezing, severe asthma. But today, the city has issued an air quality alert. In a quiet office outside triage, Weatherton says that number could be up today.
We're seeing the same number of patients on the good days and the bad days, but there's an increase of about 60% based on the respiratory complaints.
Weatherton says he checks for air quality alerts before work. He says he believes they're effective, both in terms of how they help him treat patients, as well as how some patients might take precautions.
I might spend a little more time with the patient discussing the do's and don'ts on those type of days. I have heard patients, when I mention that it's a poor air quality day, they do say, oh yes, I did hear that.
Still, even if you don't already have respiratory problems, Weatherton says poor air quality affects us all. The city's annual survey about air quality alert days shows that more residents are beginning to believe they can have an impact on air quality by changing certain behaviors. And they say air quality is an important facet of quality of life. But the extent to which they're changing those behaviors to have it is still an open question. For WFBL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
The Kentucky Public Service Commission is advising home and business owners to brace for significantly higher heating bills this winter. I talked to the PSC's Andrew Melnikovich about what Kentuckians can do to keep them manageable. Why are heating costs going to be so much higher this winter?
Well, it's because the wholesale price of natural gas has gone high. That is certainly continuing the trend that we've seen since about 2003. There's been a steady increase in the wholesale price of natural gas, which is, of course, an unregulated commodity. And that's been driven, for the most part, up until this year, by the increased demand, largely as a result of utilities shifting from other fuels to natural gas for electric generation. But what we're seeing this year seems to be a little bit different. If you talk to the people who follow the market, they will tell you that there is seems to be a flow of investment capital, not only into natural gas, but into a whole range of commodities as an investment tool, and which really, in a way, makes sense. It's gotten pretty hard to make money in the stock market and other, you know, more typical investment vehicles, certainly such as real estate. So the money's going to go where there's money to be made, and that seems to be commodities right now. And that seems to be attributed as one of the causes of this increase that we're seeing in the price of natural gas, because the underlying market fundamentals aren't there to explain it. There's plenty of gas. There's plenty of gas in storage. There's no unusual demand spike, no supply disruption that would normally underlie this kind of an increase.
Any estimate or handle at this point on just how much higher the natural gas will, how much will it will be?
Well, we know that right now, on a year-to-year basis, when you look at the gas cost adjustments, which is the pass-through cost that the utilities that provide retail gas service pass through to their customers to reflect what the utilities pay for the natural gas, and that's, you know, on a dollar-for-dollar basis. Right now, for the current period of the next 3 months or so, those year-to-year costs are up about 65% over last year. Now, whether that will hold once we get to the heating season in November, we really don't know yet, because what has happened in just in the last few weeks is the price of natural gas has come down quite a bit. That seems to be, you know, and people are starting to realize that, you know, there's plenty of gas in storage, there's plenty of gas in the pipelines. It doesn't look like we're going to have, at least right now, any supply issues going into the heating season. So the price, the market fundamentals are starting to come into play again, and the price has backed off some in the last few weeks. And if that trend continues, then we may actually see prices lower in November than they are now, which would, of course, be a very welcome development for everybody who heats with natural gas.
And most Kentuckians use natural gas?
It's about 40% of Kentuckians use natural gas. You know, when you look at where we are on natural gas versus other fuels, it's 40 to 45% on natural gas, about the same number on electric heat, and then the remainder is mostly propane, and then there's the rest is heating oil and people who use fuels such as wood, or even a few people still heat with coal. So it's certainly one of the two major heating fuels in Kentucky, along with electricity.
Are those costs going up as well, propane, fuel oil, electric?
Fuel oil has gone up even more than natural gas has, but that's a very small portion of the Kentucky market. Only about 3 or 4% of Kentuckians heat with fuel oil, but those costs have roughly doubled since last year. You know, fuel oil is similar to diesel, and we've all seen what's happened to the price of diesel, and the price of fuel oil has done something very similar to that. Propane is up, and electricity is going to be up as well because the price of coal is up.
I see. Now, you're asking, advising consumers at this point to kind of get ahead of the curve and take some steps to get ready for the winter.
Absolutely. One thing that people can do is get on a budget billing plan, which will spread those winter heating costs out over the entire year, and doesn't save you any money, but it certainly makes it a little easier to deal with the price, because the costs are spread out over a longer period, over the months when you're not using as much natural gas. And then the other thing, of course, is take whatever steps you can to reduce consumption. And that's weatherizing homes, doing things like making sure that the caulking around your window and door frames is in good shape, that the weather stripping around doors is in good shape, that you've got adequate insulation, particularly in crawl spaces and attics. And then, of course, once the heating season arrives, you know, sort of discipline yourself not to turn that thermostat up to 72 degrees or 74 degrees. Keep it down in the 68-degree range, and you'll burn a lot less natural gas.
And there is assistance available out there for those who need help.
Yes, there is. Now, in the last few years, that assistance has had a hard time keeping pace with the demand, and that certainly looks to be the case again this year. Yeah. So the folks who might be eligible for the low-income home energy assistance program, if you haven't been eligible in the past and you think you might be this year, you need to get all your ducks in a row to make sure that you've got the paperwork that's necessary to apply. And that goes through the Community Action Agency, so people can contact their local agency for that information. You know, if the prices stay high, even if they're only slightly higher than last year, it's going to be a tough winter, because people are facing not only will they be facing higher home heating costs, but that's in the context of the economic conditions that we're in right now, with energy costs in general having gone up. So people are paying much more to keep their motor vehicles on the road, and they're also paying much more for things such as food. So consumers are unfortunately really getting squeezed.
We'll hope for a mild winter at least.
That is the best thing that we could get, would be a mild winter, because that will not only will that reduce consumption, but if you reduce consumption, which reduces demand, the price tends to come down as well. I mean, the market sooner or later is going to respond to what the fundamentals out there are in terms of supply and demand. So if we have a warm winter, that will help in more ways than one.
That was the Kentucky Public Service Commission's Andrew Melnikovich. More information about natural gas prices and ways to make your home more heat efficient is available at our website, WFPL.org. Still ahead, mining the natural resources of asteroids. It could happen sooner than you think. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Last week, representatives from private business, NASA, Kentucky Space, and the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation gathered at Shaker Village to discuss the feasibility of mining asteroids and the commercialization of space. WFPL's Gabe Bullard spoke with KSTC President Chris Kimmel to get more information on the conference, Kentucky's space program, and how it's possible to mine an asteroid.
Is space travel to a point where it's possible to land on an asteroid and develop it?
We're at a point now where certainly there are still many, many challenges that remain in commercializing space. But the technology is there, or if not completely developed, nearly there to actually allow for, sure, the travel to an asteroid in a robotic mission and the return of at least perhaps 100 kilograms or so of material from that asteroid as a first step towards a more large-scale mission to an asteroid. In terms of commercially viable, again, it comes down to certainly cost and return on investment, but we know that particular asteroids have very high concentrations of very valuable materials and elements like platinum and other kinds of things that would make it profitable to travel to an asteroid and to mine, develop, and bring those assets back either into low Earth orbit, more than likely, or certainly back to Earth.
It would make up for the expense of traveling to the asteroid and developing the program for what you could bring back from an asteroid that's inside.
Correct.
Of it.
I mean, obviously, you're looking at the travel to an asteroid with the right technology, getting there, retrieving the assets, bringing them safely back to Earth would not be an inexpensive venture, probably at least tens of millions of dollars. On the other hand, some asteroids have been estimated to have assets like platinum, metals of that nature, in excess of billions of dollars. And so on a cost-benefit, cost-return basis, it certainly, at least on the face of it, makes commercial sense that given the right kinds of conditions, you could develop a profitable model, business model, to mine and develop an asteroid or asteroids.
And these are asteroids that are in orbit around the sun?
These are asteroids that are basically in orbit around the Earth, or at least in with low Earth orbit type vicinity that come into at least the range of Earth, perhaps some cases only within every 4 to 5 or 6 years, but make it feasible because of their orbits to be reached from Earth.
And so, how would it work to go about landing on the asteroid? Would it be something maybe like the moon landing was, where there's something orbiting as a module goes down? Or is it whatever shot?
The actual mechanics of landing a vehicle, a robotic vehicle, on an asteroid would probably vary a little bit. But clearly it would be a robotic mission, which would require some sort of a landing of some sort of system that would allow you a soft landing on the body itself. And then depending upon what you're trying to do, if you're bringing back a fairly small amount of material or a large amount of material, that would obviously dictate a lot of the things and the costs that would be involved.
When could there be a robotic mission to an asteroid to land on it and bring something back?
Really, from the discussion we've had over the past 3 days, we felt that a small robotic mission, a return mission, was certainly feasible within 5 to 7 years. And we are basically taking that to the next step and came out of this 3-day meeting with some questions that still needed to be answered, which we're going to be investigating, and then taking it, probably bringing the group back together in the not-too-distant future to look at the additional information. But I think the consensus was that such a mission to bring back perhaps, again, 100 to 200 kilograms of material was certainly feasible and doable within 5 to 7 years.
Would there ever be, are you ever planning on having a manned mission?
We did not talk about any kind of manned mission to asteroids. I know that has been discussed in certain quarters, but it's not something that we were really looking at.
What would you have to go through to launch a private vessel into space?
Well, you'd have to come up with a commercial viable strategy. I mean, basically, you'd have to have all of your financing in place, the technology, the mission clearly lined out, you know, all the risks mitigated to the extent possible. Everything you'd have to have basically to do a similar type of mining mission on Earth, although it would be very, very different and the risk would be very, very different. There's certain also certain legal aspects about doing business in space that aren't completely clear and worked out at this point. But basically, you know, you would be everything else. You'd have your vehicle and you'd have to contract for a launch that would get you into the orbit you needed to be to then propel yourself into or toward your target asteroid. So it would be like basically, I mean, even though you're dealing with a very different environment, it'd basically be putting together a business, fragments of business plan like you would mining a very, very remote exotic place on Earth, or perhaps recovering a material from a sunken treasure boat or something of that nature.
How do you work this out as far as rights to use the asteroid? For example, would you say that one country would claim an asteroid? Would you say that it's collectively belonging to every country? How would that be handled?
Well, clearly space law plays an integral part in any kind of commercial venture. And since we haven't really commenced with a lot of commercial ventures in space, particularly those relevant to being on other bodies other than the moon, the United States being on the moon and bringing back samples, and I believe the Russians also brought back some samples. One of the people we had at the meeting actually was Jim Dunstan, who's an attorney from Washington who is an expert in space law, and we talked about some of the legal issues that were involved. I don't think there's a space treaty right now that would prohibit a particular company or a particular country from saying, quote, we own this asteroid, or we own this real estate, etc. Actually, we believe that there is some precedent through the moon rocks that return to saying perhaps that an organization or an individual who actually mined certain materials and brought them back might have rights to those. But again, this is something that would have to be worked out and something that would have to be explored, because there isn't, again, any clear precedent at this point. And those are, in fact, important issues. And any business strategy you put together would have to include the legal case.
Do you think with the shuttle program kind of winding down that the future of just space exploration and travel and of just people in space in general is going to come from the private sector?
I think more and more you're going to see the private sector taking a leadership role. I think NASA, certainly other governments, China, Russia, Japan, India, all are developing and have very ambitious space programs. And I think large public organizations are always going to play an important role. But I think in terms of really the entrepreneurial development of space, which is, I think, where a lot of space is going to head to, I think that is clearly going to be driven from the private sector. We already have many companies, SpaceX and others, who are developing private launch vehicles. We have Sir Richard Branson and others who are developing, space tourism, taking individuals up into suborbital space, and I do think that the faster, less expensive, more ambitious efforts that will take up perhaps a larger and larger piece of commercial space in the future are clearly going to be driven by the private sector and entrepreneurs.
What role would NASA have in that?
Well, I think NASA has a tremendous amount of expertise and talent and experience and technology that's always been developed, and right now they obviously have possess the launch vehicles that provide transportation into space. So I think that the knowledge that NASA possesses, the experience, will continue to play a major role. I just think you may see private companies doing more of the execution, particular on different kinds, particular kinds of missions.
Space is, I mean, no joke intended here, the next commercial frontier, you're saying?
I think space is definitely one of the next commercial frontiers. I mean, certainly things like nanotechnology, biotechnology, alternative energy are also probably near-term frontiers as well. But I believe that within the next 5 years or so, 5 to 8 years, we're going to see just really an explosion of activity related to space in a lot of different realms. And I do believe that space is rapidly reaching the point where it is accessible, more accessible on a more inexpensive basis. I think the technology is reaching a point where we're going to be doing a lot more things, and I think you're going to see some very, very ambitious missions in space by both NASA and private companies in the next 5 to 8 years, and certainly much more frequent travel trips to space for robotic missions, and again, perhaps for suborbital flights for tourists.
What kind of ambitious missions do you think, aside from the commercial ventures, could be happening soon?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we've certainly NASA's got an objective, this nation's got an objective to return to the moon by 2020. They're working on those kinds of activities. There's talking about additional robotic missions to Mars. I mean, I think the Mars missions that we have successfully put on the surface over the past several years have just been phenomenal, and the pictures that are coming back are phenomenal, and they're adding just a great deal to the knowledge base of science. And so I think with those successes, you're going to see bolder steps taken on robotic missions to Mars. Ultimately, we'll see, I believe, we'll see humans on Mars. I'm not exactly sure when. But again, I think returns to the moon, experimentation with energy from space, I think is gaining more and more interest from a lot of different people. And again, of asteroids, for a variety of purposes, I think are going to be the target of increasing focus and activity.
And what role will Kentucky Space have in all of this?
Well, Kentucky Space, we hope to play a major role in this. I mean, Kentucky Space is a nonprofit enterprise comprised of universities and public and private companies, all engaged in basically the research and development of space-related activity and the design and flight and operation of small satellites. Kentucky Space did its first suborbital flight, back in December of 2007. We did our first high-altitude balloon launch just last month, where we went up almost 93,000 feet with a payload. And we are completing right now on the final months of the final design and testing of Kentucky Sat 1, which is our first orbital satellite, which will be done in November and is scheduled to fly in the mid part of 2009. And our objective is that once we hit orbit with our first mission, that we will fly an orbital mission every 12 to 18 months, as well as high-altitude balloon launches, suborbital flights, and other related activities.
Clearly, NASA and the space program was pretty influential for inspiring students to get into math and science. Then it seems like, anyway, that it would be a very inspirational thing. Do you think this new wave of space exploration and space commercialization and all of this is going to really get students in Kentucky and around the country, just younger people, interested in space and then interested in science and math and those fields?
Yes, I do. I think, you know, initially during a Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo space program was obviously a great magnet and excitement for people. It was also somewhat limited. You could go in and you could hope to perhaps become a part of NASA and participate in this space program. I think with the proliferation of space activity and greater opportunities, you're seeing it's basically the opportunity to be involved in space is spreading out, and potentially a lot more people can be involved in space. And younger students can be involved in space. So I do think that we're headed for, in a sense, another wave of interest in space brought about by an easier accessibility, cheaper flights into space, a broadening of space activity to more commercial ventures, some of which are relatively low cost, comparatively speaking. And yes, I do think that we're going to see, through these opportunities, a renewed interest and excitement in space that can be used to drive interest in science and mathematics education.
That was Chris Kimmel, president of the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation, talking with WFPL's Gabe Bullard. The funeral for Paul Moon Mullins was held Thursday in Springboro, Ohio. The Menifee County, Kentucky native was a celebrated bluegrass musician, as well as a disc jockey in eastern Kentucky and Ohio. He died a week ago at the age of 71. Kentucky Public Radio's Nicole Beck has this remembrance.
We'll do this, drop this down one fret, boys, and sing it. Here's a song we have recorded entitled, Who'll Sing for Me?
Moon Mullins' family says he had been suffering from a neurological disease known as progressive supranuclear palsy. The illness is often misdiagnosed as Parkinson's. He was born in Frenchburg and started his radio career at WUGO in Grayson. He also worked at WTCR in Ashland and WMST in Mount Sterling. He's most remembered for his time at WPFB in Middletown, Ohio. His son, Joe, says that's where he hit it big.
with the thousands of Appalachian transplants, Appalachian migrants that had left Kentucky and Tennessee and Virginia and West Virginia over those decades of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, man, it was a taste of home when they got to hear my dad on the radio. And he was genuine, not only in his passion for music, but he was a real mountaineer, you know, raised there in eastern Kentucky.
Joe Mullen says although many of Moon's listeners never had a chance to meet him, his father connected with a lot of people.
One friend of mine told me a few years ago, he said, I never have met your dad. He said, but I've rode to work and back with him thousands of miles. People would hear Dad in the morning during drive time. He did an early morning shift, and he did an afternoon shift as well for many, many years, so they would hear him on the way to work and on the way home, and Moon was their friend.
Lynn Dudley was an engineer at WPFB in the mid-70s, where he worked with Moon Mullins. Dudley says Moon was an original.
One of the funniest things I ever heard him say was in the hot August day, he'd say, regarding the weather, it was so hot and dry outside, the trees were chasing the dogs.
He says Mullins had an exceptional ear for detecting a worn needle on the turntables.
Things would sound fine to us, but he'd call us and say, would you come change this stylus? And something about it, he could hear stuff in the grooves and such that we couldn't. You know, you didn't argue, didn't bicker, didn't try to read, just change the needle. You know, there's no point in trying to debate it with him.
Moon was named Broadcaster of the Year in October of 2000 by the International Bluegrass Music Association. The IBMA also presented him with the Distinguished Achievement Award at that time. Mullins was a respected musician in his own right, singing and playing the dobro and fiddle. Chubby Howard was his longtime friend and co-worker.
Moon was pure country, bluegrass, and he was a great fiddler, worked with the boys from Indiana, as you know, Ralph Stanley, a bunch of them years ago when he started, and his good friend and great friend that he worked with when they were young was Tom T. Hall.
Mullins' own group, the Traditional Grass, disbanded in 1995. In 2000, he was presented the Ohio Heritage Fellowship Award for the Performing Arts. Mullins is known for being humble. Chubby says Moon should have gotten more credit for his fiddle playing. He says Mullins did what he could to promote up-and-coming talent.
He was quite a man. He deserves a lot of credit because he's the guy that really helped many years ago when they were young, Keith Whitley and Ricky Skaggs. They was on the show with him many years ago, and he'd tell his folks, you buy those boys guitars, they're going to be great.
Lynn Dudley engineered several remotes with Moon at WPFB.
Occasionally, one of those tour buses would show up out in the parking lot, and out come about 8 or 10 pickers. By golly, he'd have the fiddles, the banjo players, the dobros, the mandolins, the doghouse bass, all pile in the studio, and there were only two microphones in there, one for the newsman and one for the air personality. And they just pick away for, you know, pausing for the occasional required commercials.
Moon often ad-libbed those commercials, and Dudley says the broadcaster wouldn't advertise anything he did not believe in.
A lot of it, you know, spoken from the heart. You could take it to the bank if he said, you know, that this place had quality and good craftsmanship. You didn't need to question it. People took him at his word because that's the kind of guy, I wish there were more like him, that you could, you know, listen to his show and patronize the sponsors and know that, you know, he's, as I said, I think he spoke from the heart, and that's the way to do it. That's the way to be successful, and he was very.
Paul Moon Mullins retired from broadcasting in 2005 after 45 years in the business. He was admitted 6 weeks ago to the Hillspring Nursing Facility in Springboro, where he passed away Sunday evening.
When I reach my journey's end, tell me who will sing for me.
Chubby Howard.
He was just a great man, and I'm really sad about the loss of Paul, but he has been a fight in his health now for quite a spell, so he'll rest easy now, and as the saying goes, he'll end up in hillbilly heaven.
In Moorhead, Kentucky, I'm Nicole Back.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, including WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.